information.
Yes.
Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals the hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. When you are by my side,
Peace out, dog.
With the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. Happy Shabbat, and this is a special Shabbat. It is either Pesach, or soon will be Pesach, or it is a month after Pesach celebration. Hello, JB and Kirk. This is one of those times where I think a person can make a wonderful argument, an argument I mean in the best possible use of the word, in favor of Pesach ought to have been celebrated a 29 and a half days ago on the last full moon, or that Pesach could be celebrated this evening. And I think there's more of us that are celebrating it this evening. But in this particular case, I actually think that the moon was such and the timing of it was such that a very, very good case could have been made for for one full lunar month ago. And you know, the nice thing is you can do both. Yep. In fact, I will tell you, you guys, that I wrote to you guys a letter. My timing, regardless whether it was 4 weeks ago or tonight, was definitely off by Floridian standards, because I finished my Pesach meal about an hour ago, and while I think the sun is about ready to set or be set within the next 30 minutes or so, it's cloudy here, very overcast and rainy, stormy. It's really a wonderful night. I love stormy nights. But we can't even come close to seeing the sun here. And to be able to participate in this program tonight and celebrate with everyone, I chose to observe Pesach on Jerusalem time. And so it was earlier than normal, and I want to tell you, not only am I quite convinced that Yahweh was not the least bit disturbed that we celebrated a little bit early, but I had one of the guys that was working on my boat, who I've come to really like, and he's single, was going home to an empty house, and invited him in, and it was just a really an interesting conversation with him, because what I had to explain to him, I said, listen, I'm eating Pesach. Let me tell you what the importance of it is. I used to be a Christian. I'm not anymore. And so I most certainly will not be celebrating Easter. In fact, I recognize that Easter is a Babylonian holiday. But it's important that you know a little bit about what I know, because what I don't want to know if you're circumcised or not, I want you to know that if you're not, you're not joining me in having Pesach. You're having a lovely lamb dinner. And let me tell you the reasons behind that. And in a moment here, we'll kind of get into that, because I think it's important for people to understand that the Christian approach, even if you were to recognize that Yosha was the Pesach lamb, because said Yashayah 53. Don't even think about celebrating Pesach unless you're willing to go all the way and celebrate all seven of the Moed Mikre and accept all five of the covenant conditions, and if you're a man, unless you're circumcised. But it was just a marvelous discussion with this man that was really questioning his Christianity and realized there was a lot of dark stuff into it. And so had a very interesting evening in that regard. I would imagine both you guys in the earlier time zone are going to have dinner later, correct? In fact, you might even have it tomorrow, JB, with your timing.
Yeah, that's actually my plan. Actually, I was really interested in what you just talked about, because my wife and I were talking earlier today about her mom. It was curious about joining us, and you know, she was like, "Oh, well, she's questioning. She's interested." I'd like to have her. And, you know, my part, or my view, I was like, you know, part of me's like, "Yeah, I would love to have her," but another part of me's like, "I don't know. This is, to me, it's more of a family covenant thing," and I'm like, "I don't know. I don't know that I want someone who's not covenant part of it." Yeah, I enjoy spending it with covenant members, but like you just pointed out, being able to enjoy it with someone who's not, maybe opening it to them. So,
yes, I was doing that same thing. I was actually having Pesach with a covenant member, and one of the questions I asked is, you know, I have this person out working on the boat. I'm certain they're not covenant, but we have plenty of lamb. Would it bother you at all if we were really very close to being finished anyway, and we'd enjoyed everything we were doing? Would it bother you at all if I invite this person in? And the immediate answer was, you need to ask whether or not he's circumcised. And while that conversation has to come up with a man, it wouldn't have to come up with your mother-in-law, but has to come up with a man. There's a way to weave it into the conversation. I mean, it sounds odd, but there's a way. In fact, I did it. A way to weave it into the conversation where it was really showing a concern for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I ended up doing was simply telling him that, went through the background of what Easter is. This year is a perfect comparison, because this is one of the few years where Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim fall on the same days of the week they did in year 4000 Yom 33 CE. You know, you had the Pesach dinner commence such that Yosha could eat the Pesach dinner and still be the Pesach lamb and serve as the Pesach lamb. And then his soul go to Matzah and then celebrate first fruits on the first day of the week. And so we went through all of that. And the other question was, I said, you know, Easter. And he said, you know, but Easter is significant of the resurrection. So there was no resurrection. Mm-hmm. The body of the Passover lamb was destroyed. Have you ever wondered why Yosha, which is his real name, said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Have you ever wondered, you know, that wasn't a question. It's, look here if you want to understand it. He's reciting from the 22nd Psalm, written exactly 1,000 years earlier. And then why is it that his own mother didn't recognize him? How could he have undergone bodily resurrection if his own mother didn't recognize him? Can you tell me how it's possible that after spending 3 years and every moment of every day for 3 years with him, his disciples couldn't recognize him? How is it possible that he had teleported on the road to Emmaus? Was it 60 stadia from Jerusalem? And the two fellows that had been down in Jerusalem and had witnessed all of this, they don't recognize him. And then, you know, after the upper room situation, where you walk through a wall, which last time I checked, you can't do with the body, nor can you teleport with the body, all of which was required. He shows up in a boat with the disciples in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. That doesn't work either if you have a physical body. And so we went through what these things represent and then explained that they're all tied in with the covenant. And the final condition of the covenant is to be circumcised if you're a man. And so the worst possible choice, and this was your concern, I think, also, JB, the worst choice you can make as a person is to do what Christianity purports to do, which is to celebrate Pesach, although they don't really know what it's about. They call it Good Friday. But to celebrate Pesach and then ignore matzah because you've availed yourself in the doorway to life, but you're still corrupted with religious and political rebellion, which means your soul eternally has to be separated from Yahweh, which is an express ticket to Sheol. And so that's the worst possible choice a person could possibly make. That's why Christianity is really so dastardly. That's why it's obvious that Saul, was a demon-possessed. Otherwise, there is no way that he would have created something so dastardly. So, Pesach is a marvelous celebration if you're going to go all the way. If you're going to take advantage of all seven steps, if you're going to embrace the five terms and conditions of the covenant, then it's the best evening of the year. But if you're not, it's the worst. So share your statement. What'd you write, JP?
Actually, I think we've done covered most of it. It was just one of those I wanted to kind of touch on was just the differing, this year there were actually three possible dates for Pesach because, it's all dependent upon, and this is something a lot of people know, but some new people may not, and, I always go with the, I grew up reading comics, and there was a great Stan Lee quote about how, you got to write every comic as though it's somebody's first. And so, same thing with like a show like this is you have to view it as this is somebody's first time to listen. So, kind of reaching on some of those basics, it's important to touch on. And with Yahweh's calendar, it was a lunar-based calendar. It was the months, the lunar cycle determined the month. But because of that, if you didn't add a month every 3 to 5 years, you would be thrown off in terms of the seasons. You'd get what
actually every 2 to 3 years. Actually, 2 to 3 years, but yes.
Is it 2 to 3?
Correct.
Okay. But you get what Islam has with their calendar where the dates float all over the place. Because,
correct.
Yeah, they don't add a month. So Yahweh put in a method, as genius as he was, put in a method to determine when to start a new month. And that was by checking, the major crop of the area at the time was barley. And barley was harvested this time of year. And so you would examine the barley kernel to see if it was a bean, if it was ripe. And if it was ripe, you would start the new month and you would go through. If it wasn't...
Right, with the new moon closest to the green barley kernel was the beginning of your year. If the barley was not yet green and you had a new moon, then you'd go another 4 weeks.
Exactly. So it kept the seasons in time with the calendar.
So let me ask you, why would God tell people to use a lunar solar, because that is a lunar solar way of reckoning time?
Because you can see it every night in a different place.
Yes.
So you track your time.
Why did you tell them to look at a calendar or a clock?
Yeah.
They didn't have
there weren't any.
The answer is
there weren't any. No calendars, no clocks.
It was an observable, verifiable calendar that they could follow. You could look at
it was the only way of keeping track of time. Years and months was the only way of keeping track of time. And so the whole world used the observable method, which was the solar cycle, 29 and a half days. And so that would be a little under a 360-day year, 12 times 30 would be 360, but it's 6 days shy of that, so 354 days. So you about a month. Mm-hmm. And then, and it's really interesting that method is precisely accurate, even with the 365 and what and a quarter days a year.
Yeah. Yep.
It's just precisely accurate. Yeah. You know, the greatest
anything you wanted as a determination of when to add it, but, you know, the barley was, like I said, the dominant crop of the region at the time, so it was the most commonly available.
Well, okay, so let me ask you another question. Why was barley the dominant crop? Not of the region, of the world at the time. Well, certainly the world, that the civilized world at the time. Why was barley the dominant crop of the civilized world at the time?
Was it the most hardy?
Nope.
No? Versatile.
Don't know.
It created great food, and it also was used for creating beer, which was the only way to create liquid that was drinkable and sustainable.
That's the reason. Without beer, there is no civilization. No. Without beer, there is no civilization.
But beyond
almost
that,
all languages,
as well.
Except for Hebrew,
from the grain that you
grew out of beer. Written records grew out of beer.
Mm-hmm.
Civilization grew out of beer. If it wasn't for beer, there would be no civilized man, because it was the only way to make water drinkable when a lot of people were living together, because of the ability to brew it. And at the time, the central ingredient in brewing beer was barley.
Yeah, and it's barley.
You couldn't live more than a day's walk away from a water source.
Right. And, of course, the thing that made barley, turned barley into beer, was yeast,
yep.
Which is central to this particular festival feast, because removing the yeast, which turns what would essentially be bread into alcohol, is yeast. So yeast is not only the fungus that permeates the loaf, it's the substance that transforms the kernel of the barley into the intoxicant. So the whole story is really fascinating, but that is correct. And there's a metaphor also with the barley, which is that the year begins, and you begin counting when the kernel is still abib, green, and growing. In other words, receptive. As opposed to hard, dried up, or too immature to be of any value. There's just a specific time, and that's very similar to our lives. There's a particular time and place that some people are open and growing and receptive, as opposed to hard and unreceptive, or too young to even think about it. So it's just a certain time in our lives, and the whole metaphor fits together that way.
You know, it's funny how that point is different for every one of us. You know, it's not an age-based thing. You know, some of us are a bead that, you know, in our 20s. Some of us aren't until our 60s. Some people become a bead in their teens. You know, it's very much like the dating of the calendars, and that, you know, things move around, and it's subjective. Not everything is a fixed, calculable number.
You know, I became a beeb in my 40s. Moshe became a beeb in his 80s. Dode was a beeb very early on, Yirmiyah, probably a teenager. You know, Dode was a teenager. So, yeah, it's not, there's not a time, it's an attitude, not a time, not a chronology in terms of a beeb.
What else did you
write down in your note, JB?
Sorry.
I mean, Kirk had something to say.
No, I didn't want to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, the only thing I was going to ask is because from time to time people ask, why does the day start in the evening with sundown, from sundown to sundown? And my two answers are always, number one, if you read the story we're going to cover now in Egypt, they started Pesach that evening, so it had to be the new day for them.
Right.
And then in the next day they started moving away from Egypt. But if to me, I would also say that if there was no other reason whatsoever, other than to have Yosha have that chance to have peace talk with his immediate followers, so that he could service that and then become the peace talk male in reality the next day, that would have been good enough to keep it, but keep it in the calendar that way, or recognize it.
Yeah, and that's been my understanding, is that there's no other way for him to set the example and therefore be Torah observant. And being Torah observant is essential of celebrating the Pesach meal as it was intended, and then serving as the Pesach lamb. The only way that's possible is for it the way it is described, beginning in the evening.
Yeah, so they don't miss this. The people who keep records of these sort of things, the Hebrew people collectively, they're always good on the Sabbath. They know what the Sabbath is. They always know when the Yobels are. I think if you can find one Yobel, you can find them all.
Yeah.
So I mean, those are very trustworthy, reliable things, the way they're set up for Yah. Yeah, I set them up for us to understand. So, in any case, you get those questions.
And what else did you find, JB, as you were you put together your note on the, this was a year where there were multiple options?
Well, so we this year there was an option between whether it was this month or next, and if you chose to do it a month earlier, I wouldn't argue with you. I think there was a good argument for either one, because one, I don't live in Israel, I don't grow barley, I have no way of knowing whether it's a Aviv or not. My reasoning for opting for this month versus last was, the last time one of these came up, I did some research at the time, and found, based on my understanding, I thought we didn't need to add a month, and later came to find a source that actually cited that barley was not a, or was a Aviv, so they didn't add a month. So, to me, we were due for it. We hadn't had one in a while. We were due to add a month, so I opted to do that this year. But the other option, this is where me and you differ in terms of not necessarily reasoning, but you choose usually to observe the astronomical, whereas I go with the observational. And honestly, my preferred method, if it was just me, if I was in your situation where I'm on my own and it's just me doing what I want to do, I would go with the astronomical, because it is the more precise, the more calculable, the more mathematically determined date. But
particularly if you live in a place
reason,
like I do right now, where the sky is very often occluded with clouds.
Oh yeah.
And therefore, you have to really be a fairly fortunate evening to see the first sliver of light on the. On the moon, and particularly since it's in here, it's always low on the horizon near sunset, and I'm looking out over the Everglades. I mean, that's my distant view. In all of Florida, the East Coast is 5 or so miles wide, and then it goes into the Everglades, and it's always stormy. Even in the winter, it's always stormy over the Everglades. And so seeing a new moon here, that's rare evening that you would see a new moon.
Exactly. So, to me, the astronomical is the more precise. It's the way I would opt to go for it. The only reason I opt for the observational is very simple. I have a very young daughter. And so, in previous years, we've always went out. This year, it wasn't possible. It was way too cloudy. We've had way too many storms. There was no seeing it where I'm at in Texas. But, for me to be able to take her out and look for it, it's a teachable moment. And actually, that's one of the things I love with Yahweh's Word, is it appeals to all ages. And so at her age now, I can take her out and we can look for that, and that's a lesson. I'm teaching her all about this. Now, when she gets older and is capable of more abstract thought, I can walk her through the calculations to determine the astronomical. So it appeals and works for both ages. So while she's younger, I'm going with the observational, just because most years we're able to go out and look for the, I know it's coming up. I know I can calculate what day it's going to be, but we'll go out the 2 or 3 days in advance and look and be like, see, there's no, the moon's not renewed yet. Not yet. And then you go out and go, oh, see, there it is. And so you're teaching, and it works as a great teaching tool. So, that's why, you and I were doing two different nights this year. in terms of...
And by the way, the difference between the observational and the astronomical is at most one day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The only difference by day.
Well, even if you
had
chosen
where you have the issue is every 2 to 3 years. Yeah, there is a debate every 2 to 3 years on what month represents the first month of the year, the Abib month. And normally, 1 month is much closer to what is essentially the demarcation, although it's not mentioned. But for the most part, the closer you are to the vernal equinox, the closer you're going to be to the time that throughout history, barley would be, which is the first grain to come into kernel, but you'd be, most years, it's going to be the renewing light on the moon closest to the vernal equinox, which I think right now is March 22nd. It, you know, it's not always that date, and yeah, it doesn't use our calendar, but that is typically the time, and so if you're dealing with observational versus astronomical, it's really just one day, and I use a modified astronomical, because for two reasons. One is the astronomical is based upon NASA using the time as it is observed in the West, which is that days end at midnight. So long as it would be renewing light on the moon, even if the moon has technically set for where you are, but it occurs prior to midnight, that would be recorded as the renewed light on the moon. That's right, new moon on that day. But that would actually be the next day from the Hebrew reckoning, and it would be beyond what could possibly be seen, because it would be after sunset. So I use a modified version where I would say that it has to be at least 1%, and that renewable condition would have to have occurred prior to sunset as opposed to prior to midnight. So
makes sense.
That's just the way that I look at it. It seems that I like logical approaches. And that's a very logical way for me to go about it, so long as I'm never dogmatic about it. Like I've shared, this is how I go about it. I'm not teaching that this is how someone else should go about it. The only one example I want to make is to thoughtfully consider the options, understand what they are, is always a good thing. But if we come to a different conclusion, that's fine too. Because that's one of the interesting things, is that since Pesach begins at sunset on the 14th day, well, that indicates to me that that would be the 13th day at sunset, because the 13th day at sunset, the moment the sun sets, it's the 14th day. Which means you'd be eating the meal on the 14th day. Because if you then celebrated Pesach on the 14th day at sunset, the moment you began the meal, it would be the 15th day, which would be matzah. So, that's my thinking on it, and I like the way that Yosha ate the Pesach meal and then became the Pesach lamb. In 33 CE, and so there's lots of reasons that I think that you can think your way through it, but there's lots of ways for different conclusions.
That's actually an area where I've come to a different conclusion than you, in that I think Pesach itself begins on the as the sun sets on the 13th day. I've opted to, in the last three, four years now, I've chosen to celebrate it at the end of the 14th day. So, for me, when the sun sets tonight, which will be around 8 o'clock my time, that to me will begin the 14th day, which will be the beginning of Pesach, but I will not be grilling my lamb. I will grill my lamb tomorrow in preparation to eat it as the sun sets. So I choose to celebrate it and keep the drill my lamb and, you know, all that at the end of the 14th day so that I'm sitting there, I'm eating and enjoying the Pesach lamb as the 14th day ends and matzah begins. To me, that, you know, that's based on how I've looked at my understanding of the timing of the Exodus account and, you know, the instructions regarding Pesach. It makes the most sense to me. And it, to me, what I love about that is it blends Pesach and matzah as, you know, inseparable. You
cannot, yeah, that's my favorite part of your,
yeah, you cannot of your view, like,
and it doesn't think it's inseparable. If they're not inseparable, you're in trouble.
Exactly. So, you know, you were celebrating Pesach. You were enjoying the Pesach lamb while matzah begins. And that, to me, fits with why, you know, matzah is part of Pesach meal, and, you know, it all just blends together into this one big celebration. And, yeah, cause that's
right.
One area where me and you differ, and, yeah, we're okay with that.
No, we agree that it's not all together into one celebration. We agree on that. When we have, and the history we have on timing, you're not hearing any pushback from me at all. No, there's aspects of your timing that I happen to really like and resonate with me. You know, my view on this whole thing, and I think it ought to be all of our views, is that understanding what Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim represent, celebrating them, accepting them, sharing them, answering Yahweh's invitation to party with them, that's what's important. Understanding the relationship between these first four fulfilled Moed Mikre and the terms and conditions of the covenant and their benefits, that's essential. The timing that we choose to celebrate them, well, we'd all like to be doing it consistent with Yahweh's instructions. On a 1 to 10 scale, that's a 1. We're understanding and accepting the benefits, it's 10. So,
yeah.
There is a reason that God didn't make anything that he said simplistic, such that it could become dogmatic, such that someone could do it without thinking about it. I don't think there's anything. And not in the meaning of Pesach, not in the timing of Pesach, not in the meaning of matzah, not in the timing of matzah. I don't think there's anything that Yahweh said regarding the seven Moed Mikre, or the terms and conditions of the covenants, or their benefits, or how to observe the Torah. I don't think there's anything that he said that could be simplistically dumbed down so that someone could go through the motions without understanding them and accepting them. And that's by design. I mean, I can't be a better communicator than Yahweh is. And so, since he has communicated it this way, and there's no doubt that you can't make an emphatic statement on being dogmatic about any of this.
No.
It's obviously because he wants us to independently think our way through this, to celebrate the whole process of coming to know.
Well,
do you want me to comment? JB, a week ago that a couple of people have written me on, a couple of people have written, then lots of people have probably chafed at it. I guess I had three people that wrote. Two pretty nicely, one very, one not so nicely. But the one that wasn't nice was still caught up in their underwear over a conspiracy when that really was the driver. What I said was, and at the time, I was addressing those who claim they are covenant because they parrot the words, but are still promoting the worst of Babel, which is conspiracy. And I say that conspiracy is the worst of Babel because it really is for them and this particular group where they're intermixing Yahweh's vocabulary, his testimony, with just absurd babble, conspiratorial lies. And these aren't lies that are kind of interesting through history to figure out how Satan has become the god of religion. No, these are, you know, things that are just stupid, like that the school massacres and the mass killings and nightclubs and that sort of thing are government plots with government actors carrying them out, and that real people weren't actually killed in them, or that, you know, building 7 of the World Trade Center proves that it was a government plot and that it wasn't an Islamic terrorist act, or that airplanes don't emit chemtrails or contrails, they emit chemtrails, which is a government plot to poison us at 30,000 feet. That's the worst of Babel. And what I said was that if you're co-mixing Yahweh's truth with that kind of stupidity, you're not a member of the covenant. Because the first condition of the covenant is to walk away from that stuff. And so what I said was, and I was trying to convey it directed to those people, is that if you're not taking this seriously, if you don't, look up a word now and then, really ponder this, take your time and think about it, invest in learning this to the point that Yah's message resonates within you. You really understand what he's asking and why he's asking it. Then you're
I always
yourself.
Love the term you use, own. Until you own the material.
Right, own it. Right,
that,
own it.
I mean, that is the best word to use for it. Until it is yours.
Yeah.
It's not your
and
you
know, I probably
God,
said something that isn't,
isn't
appropriate. And I said it just in the going out to these people who just parrot things as opposed to understand it. They don't own it. They parrot it. And they don't own it largely because they stay in the artificial world of Facebook and they just exchange likes and video chats and parrot the same thoughts back to one another. They don't do any investigation. And I said, you really can't be in the covenant unless you've done enough investigation to own the material. And I know there's a lot of people who are covenant, who haven't gone online to validate whether or not my translations are true, or look up a word, or try to translate on their own, who are celebrating Pesach along with us, who have accepted the terms of the covenant and genuinely understand them and participate in them. Do I think they would be better off, even in the hustle bustle of their lives, to enjoy that process of validating Yahweh's testimony? I think they'd find it an enormous satisfaction. But the real issue is you got to own the material. It's important. It's important that we do as much as is humanly possible what Yahweh is going to do for us when he reaffirms his covenant, which is that he's going to write his Torah inside of us, that to the greatest degree possible for us to incorporate it. This is going to make a tremendous difference. You know, I don't know if I was dry-eyed for even an hour of yesterday. Yesterday I was writing commentary and doing translations on 4 or 5 of the most poignant, sad passages that I've ever read. And I was writing the commentary on it to help people see it from God's perspective. And so my words were just me getting inside of God's head, if you will. And it's not hard to do because he gave us the tools to do that, to see things from his perspective. And as I would write what he has just said and what it means to his people, it's just tears. And that's all a derivative of over the years changing my mindset and perspective to his. I was going to just say, he has presented this, it seems not only appropriate to me, but it's his universe. It's beneficial for all of us, including me, to see things from his perspective. And so that's kind of what I mean by owning it. Mm-hmm. Is you change your perspective, you change your thinking. It is when somebody is promoting a religious idea or a conspiratorial idea or a political idea, you're repulsed. And your view is, if they want to do that apart from the covenant, they're lost, but let them. But if they're going to promote a lie in your presence, then we have to shut it down. We have to, you know, if you look at, and it was a passage that, when we're going to get to this sooner rather than later, because it's the most moving experience I've had in the 18 years I've done this, to explain the what Moab is. Who would have thought? The two chapters that I didn't want to write, that I went through as fast as I could possibly get to, because Moab hasn't existed for 2,500 years, almost 2,900 years. I just wanted to get through it. And after finishing the last chapter of Volume 2, I went back because I knew I hadn't done it justice. And the most moving experience I've ever had, 18 years of doing this, has been defining who Moab is. And we're going to get to it sooner rather than later. And what it... what you end up doing is it just changes your entire perspective. So it's I don't even know, I have the words for it, but it's the one of the attacks. I think JB, you mentioned it in the in this before the show began. One of those people, and I was delighted with the most recent letter because it was so poorly written. I said, yeah, that's the best. That's what they're going to be like. That's the best they've got to offer. I can just ignore it, and I did, and didn't even respond. But what they accused me of doing is because I said, you know, you can't be part of the covenant if you're continuing to advance politics, religion, or conspiracy. And so they wrote, you know, who made you the gatekeeper? Right? Isn't that kind of what the gist was?
Yeah.
Yeah, we said so. Then.
Yeah. And I'm not the gatekeeper. And yet we're all gatekeepers. What do I mean by that? If God gave us the criterion for being in the covenant, and we understand what that criterion is, and somebody is doing the antithesis of that,
mm-hmm.
What are we supposed to say? Hey, Saul, welcome in. God was just kidding about that stuff, about that Babel stuff. I mean, let's just overlook the fact that that's where Abraham had come out of. Let's overlook the fact that Yahweh said to a man that had already walked away from his country, you need to walk away from your country. You need to walk away from societal influences. You have to walk away from your father's house. Let's just ignore that. And why don't we go back to the Christian God who is all accommodating, wants to save everybody? Or are we supposed to say, no, God was really clear. He said, these are the conditions, these are the things that he expected from Abraham, and that he never changes. And it's an everlasting covenant. And he said, these are the benefits, and I will provide those benefits to anybody who accepts those conditions. Are we supposed to say, if you aren't accepting of those conditions, you aren't part of the covenant? And please tell me if where you see the flaw in that reasoning.
Yeah. That was kind of part of the whole thing that led to this. Yeah, my whole discussion then was that whole comment, this idea that, oh, Craig is just being a gatekeeper, and if you disagree with him, you're not part of the covenant. No, I disagree with you on several things, and you have no problem with that. But, a perfect example that I will use, now I will lay down, this is where I will lay down the gauntlet, circumcision. I am sorry, if you are not circumcised, you are not part of the covenant. I can say that definitively, beyond a shadow of a doubt, without hesitation. You know why? Because Yahweh said that definitively, beyond a shadow of a doubt, without hesitation. He said in Barashi, if any male who is not circumcised has nullified, voided, and made for naught my covenant, I can make that statement. I'm not playing gatekeeper. I'm not saying you have to agree with me on everything. But when Yahweh says this for fact, and I say it for fact, then yes, if you don't follow that, it's not me. It's what he said.
Okay, let me ask you a question.
But here's the thing. You know, if you have not walked away from religion, which conspiracy theory is religion, you are not part of the covenant. Yahweh said that.
Right. Right. Now, I would go, just to be really straightforward, is what is the definition of Babylon, Babel? What does it mean?
Confusion.
Intermixing and confusing.
Right. To confuse by intermixing. Right. So that is the definition of Babel. What country did Abram at the time walk away from?
Babylon.
Correct. So when Yahweh told him that he had to walk away from his country, it was walking away from where?
Babylon.
Correct. And what does Babylon mean?
Confused.
There you go. So the religion of Christianity takes a little bit of Torah, twists it, intermix it with a bunch of appalling lies to create a new religion. They've confused a lot of people. Christianity is intermixing to confuse. The Quran takes some Talmud stories and mixes them together with pagan mythology, intermixes them together to confuse.
And confuse them.
I don't think there's anything worse than conspiracy in terms of intermixing truth and lies together to confuse. Can you see a condensation trail at the back of an airplane?
Absolutely. Yeah, all the time.
Is it a condensation trail or is it a chemtrail? Well, are there chemicals in it? Yes. Water is a chemical.
There's chemicals in air.
Carbon dioxide is a chemical. Is it a government plot? Hell no. Is the government
poisoning people with chemicals being released and they're allowing it? So, I mean, it's a plot. They know there's chemicals there and they're allowing it because they know those chemicals are harmless.
Yes. Yes, as a result of combustion. But, so is it possible to say absolutely and resolutely that if you are religious, overtly promoting religion, politics, or conspiracy, that you are not in the covenant?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, black and white.
It's where Yahweh said.
Doesn't make any one of the three of us a gatekeeper. It's not a disagreement with us. I didn't create the terms and conditions of the covenant. I rather like them. I agree with them. I support them. I've accepted them. I didn't write them.
Yeah.
These are my rules. Yeah, they are my rules. And if you don't like Yahweh's rules, you're probably not going to like him. But they're his rules. He doesn't have many rules, but those are his rules. It's his house. Those are his rules. I happen to agree with all of them. I love all of them. I see benefit in all five of them. Delighted with them. You aren't going to find any sympathy from me, first of all, because I think it's really stupid to advocate something that God is opposed to, just saying here. But I happen to agree with them. I've come to realize that all five of the conditions are beneficial and helpful for all of us.
Now, you want to disagree with me on something outside of that? You want to disagree with when I choose to celebrate Pesach? All right, let's have that discussion.
I
love debate. I'm a fan of debate.
JB, we have and I don't even sure it's a slight difference here. I actually enjoy hearing why you've chosen to do it differently, one day differently, and integrate it with the matzah. I enjoy hearing that. I love your passion. I love the thought that you put into it. I love to hear the reasons that you've done it, and yet I don't feel any compulsion to change what I find to be more satisfying in terms of my answer, because the timing of it isn't essential. If the timing of it was so essential, God would have given us a much better way to be able to have it. He would have said astronomical or observational, but he didn't. He would have defined what is Kodesh, the renewing light. Is it 0? Is it 1%? Is it 2%? When does it have to happen? Before the sun sets? He would have made it vastly clearer if he was fixated on the religious approach of, you know, this is the date. He wasn't. So having a thoughtful discussion about various options, why it's that way.
But by the same token, if you try and argue with me that quote-unquote Good Friday is when we should be celebrating Pesach every year based on your Catholic calendar of however, I don't even know how they came up with their calculation.
Yeah, go to hell.
There's
no difference between Imperial Rome and Roman Catholicism.
Well, yeah.
Same beast.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know what calculation they use to determine. You know, this year it actually happens to fall pretty much on track. But by and large, they try and avoid making it fall on the right
time. Oh, they
hate
it.
And what
they're so confused by it, they will never allow.
I'm going to argue with you on that. Because the Catholic calendar is outright wrong. It is not using anything Yahweh had to say.
Correct. Yeah, well, it was the Julian calendar that became the Gregorian calendar based upon the fact that the human calendar wasn't as accurate as Yahweh's calendar, and their Easter fell a month away from Pesach, and they know there's a correlation there. They don't want to talk about it in any way. I think they know there's a correlation between celebrating Pesach and their Last Supper. I think they know there's a correlation between what happened on Good Friday and the Passover lamb. They know there's a correlation, but they don't want Passover to fall on Easter ever.
No.
And so they do have a means of communicating their calendar. Yeah.
Can I say a little?
Sure.
Jump in for a second. I hear JB's arguments, and I've read what he says, and I've read what you've said, and I'm good with all that. I'm going, you know, we're going to have dinner tonight with sundown, and that's fine with me, and I'm using Yoel's chart, basically.
Yes.
My favorite story, one of my favorite stories is Hezekiah or Chizkiyah.
Yeah, of course.
Huh? When I was studying, and he's all over the board because he can't get it all done. I mean, he's
right.
But the thing that was so good about his story, the thing that you about understanding it, is he obviously did because he follows the mitzvah right down the first four steps. The fifth step is academic to him because it's already been done. You know, he's the king of Israel, and in that society, everybody was circumcised, so that was not a condition that he had to all of a sudden circumcise everybody. But 1, 2, 3, 4, I mean, he stopped relying on all of his allies, his army, his money. You know, he tried to bribe the Assyrian army to go away, and they went through it. And finally, he walks totally away from Babylon and says, "This ain't working. Let's what do the old guys do?" And that's when
happened. What actually happened is that somebody found an unused copy of the Torah in Yahweh's house. Yeah, they brought it to him and said, "Hey, do you know anything about this?"
You know this?
And he read it. He read it. And he says, "Oh my goodness, we're doing everything wrong. No wonder there's 185,000 Assyrians here about ready to tear us to ribbons just like they did Israel. Maybe we ought to try this."
Yeah.
As bad as it is today, how bad did it have to be to get to a, you know, a kingdom that was literally founded out of the Torah, get to a point where the king didn't know what the Torah said?
Correct.
How bad was the world at that point?
Well, you know, for the most part, most of the kings of Israel and Yehudah were scumbags.
Yeah.
And they were just absolute trash. And their wives were worse. You know, it's terrible, the story of the kings and the queens of Israel and Yehudah is the story of some of the worst people who ever lived. It's You know, if I were pregnant, I was going to ask this question.
Mr. Ayala is made to serve as an example, you know, both of what it is, the benefits of following Yahweh and the consequences of rejecting Yahweh. Unfortunately, throughout most of their history, they've rejected Yahweh. They've served as the negative example.
For a very
small period in time, they were the positive example, but
by
and large, they were the example of what happens when you choose to reject it.
So if I were to ask you a question, what is the book? What book is the most critical of Jews? Protocols of the Elders of Zion, that farce, the Mein Kampf, Hitler's anti-Semitic rant, the Quran, which is easily the most anti-Semitic book ever written. What book would you say is the most critical of Jews?
Kings.
Probably the book. I mean, not
the book of
which
Kings.
One?
First and Second Kings.
Oh, yeah. But the Torah prophets results. That's the book that is the most critical, and the Yahweh views it all in Torah. So the book that is the most critical of Jews is not Mein Kampf. It's not Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the farce. It's not the Quran. The book that is the most critical of Jews, of Israel and Yahudam, is the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, Yahweh, testimony.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when you talk about Hezekiah, you brought up Hezekiah celebrating Pesach. What was it that required him to delay it 2 weeks?
He couldn't get rid of all the garbage, the idols and everything.
That's it. It took 2 weeks to rid the land of religious artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
What is the purpose of Pesach's unyeasted bread and the unyeasted bread for the 7 day celebration? What is its purpose?
He suffered from
removal of religion.
Sin of, yeah.
Right. And so the lesson was, if you're removing religion from the land, from your soul, from your life, it doesn't matter when you're celebrating it. Because you're celebrating it the right way.
Yeah, we've had that talk before with people who are like, you know, oh, what happens if, you know, I come to know Yahweh, but I die before my first Pesach? Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
As soon as you've reached that point where you've rejected religion, you've rejected man's way, you've come to know and understand Yahweh's plan and his way, you're part of the family. Doesn't matter if you've ever celebrated a single Pesach. You're there. That's all that matters. It all happens at once. The seven steps are symbolic. They're a teaching tool.
Right.
Yeah, the seven steps are a teaching tool. They're there. They're symbolic. They have meaning, and they're fulfilled in a certain order. But as soon as you reach that point, you've gone through all of them at once. Well, maybe not the seventh one, because that's, like we talked about last week, it isn't about us at all. That's all about Yahweh and his family. And we're
right, the sixth one, the sixth is all about Yahweh and his family. Seventh incorporates all of us. But, you know, I want to be clear on even the sixth one, which is Yom Kippur, on the Day of Reconciliations. While the reconciled are Yehudah and Yisrael, it does involve us.
We benefit from that.
And the reason it involves us is because Yisrael and Yehudah, there wasn't a single person that Yahweh could go to convey his message. Not one. He tried. Those were his go-to people. And there wasn't a single Yisraelite or Yahudim that was willing to answer his call. Not one. So the reason that we are part of Yom Kippurim, even though we're not the ones being reconciled with Yahweh on Yom Kippurim, is that we're the ones calling Yisrael and Yahudah home.
We're not
the
ones
Goyim who are willing
to
listen to Yahweh with fresh eyes and fresh and open ears and open minds to get the attention of his people. And I would say that apart from what we are doing with Yahweh's words and conveying his words, there wouldn't be a Yahud or Israelite in the covenant right now. And yet I would say it's more than half of the current covenant family is comprised of Yahud and Israelites.
I think that just goes back to the inherent genetic superiority of that race. They are smarter.
Well, they are smarter, but sometimes so smart can get you in a lot of trouble.
Well, I know. I just mean that's why they are the ones that, yeah, you said probably 50% of the people who have been receptive to this message have been.
Ah, that's true. Oh, you're right. I didn't think of it that way, but you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm not being a racist here, but all the evidence shows that they are genetically more intelligent.
Yeah, it's true.
And the evidence is empirical evidence.
It's true. And so if you're not religious and you're not a political Jew, let's use just the terms everybody knows what we're talking about, is Yahudim Jews. It means beloved of Yah and related to Yah. The statistical evidence proves emphatically that Jews are the brightest race in the history of humankind.
Mm-hmm.
They are
you,
special
you,
people.
You look at I'm drawing a blank there.
They're the founders, really, of most of religion, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, socialist secular humanism.
But you look at Nobel Prizes in the hard science, not in the Peace Prize, which was given to Gaddafi, the BS stuff.
But the science is
hard
right.
Sciences, they, or what is it, like 75%?
No, it's a little less
Nobel
than that.
Prizes have been given to...
No, it's a little less than that. I think the numbers are between the various sciences, it's anywhere from 20% is the low, 40% is typically the high. So it goes from the mid-20s is the lowest of the sciences to the mid-40s. But Jews represent 0.2% of the population.
That's right.
0.2%. And they're averaging 30%.
Percentage of population.
Right.
You know, it's... When you scale it based on population,
it's a 300-to-1 ratio.
Absurdly high number.
That's 3,000%. That means that if you use percentages, that would mean Yehudim are actually 30,000%. Because you have to move the place twice. But they're 3,000 times more likely to be a Nobel Prize winner in the sciences than any other race.
That's insane.
Yes.
You're talking objective field.
Correlation.
Feel good.
Right.
This is
and the race, by the way, is closest to them genetically.
Based on objective.
Is the worst in terms of percentage. So here you are, the race that is closest to them genetically is the least inventive in human history. And where Jews are the most inventive in human history. And we're not saying this because we're Jews and we're told in our own home, because we're not.
No.
It's just those are the facts.
Again, you're one of us here, that's Jew. Biologically.
So it's just those are the facts. And to deny the facts is to be ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think there is that secular Jews, they're open-minded and rational, are... That Yahweh's message appeals more to them than anyone else, particularly when you remove the Christian lies from the story.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but sadly, what the fastest growing religion is now in Israel? Jews for Jesus.
Don't tell me messianic.
It's really sad. Blending two lies together. It's like the Hebrew Roots movement that blends Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism together. It is essentially two wrongs make a right, and they don't. In fact, I think it's actually worse because it begins to even go closer to the truth by making the lie even more credible. Yeah.
So
let's share a little bit about Enoch. This is what
Yahweh
had to say.
2.5 years of my life to dealing with that stuff, because it took about 2.5 years for me to figure out all that messianic Judaism thing was false.
Yes.
It took a while, because there was enough truth in there that had me interested. When I was just getting interested, and I was ignorant of a lot of scripture, and I was coming to realize that the Torah was accurate, and there were these truths. But there were these lies and this paganism, and trying to sort through that, I probably wasted 1.5, 2 years of my life on the messianic Judaism movement, and that is just ridiculous.
Yahweh spoke these words to Moshe in order to promise and say, please convey the word of God on behalf of the children of Israel. And so you should literally and completely convey to them that these godly appointed meeting times, Moab, of Yahweh, which are to show the way and to provide the blessings of the relationship, set apart, invitations to be called out and to meet, to be welcomed and to greet, to read and to recite, to be near them, shall be continuously proclaimed by you as they are my godly appointed meeting times. You know, I get so angry. Righteous indignation is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
As Christians, and particularly Roman Catholics, that if you look up Passover or Matzah or any of these, they will say those are Jewish holidays.
Yeah.
Well, aren't they carrying around this book? Isn't the Torah part of their Bible? Can't they read Kara? Well, they don't know that. Can't they read Leviticus 23, 1 and 2?
Yeah, they want the credit.
These are Yahweh's
invitations. They don't follow anything it actually teaches.
Right. They're Yahweh's. They're his meeting times. If you want to meet with him, he's set the appointment. You know, you and your church don't get to change it. He set these appointments. You know, today somebody sent me a picture. I don't know if you've seen it. But for 300 years, there's been these stairs that allegedly, miraculously appeared in the Vatican from Jerusalem. And they're supposed to be stairs that Jesus walked on. Oh, my God. And they miraculously appeared in the Vatican. And they've been covered up with wood, but they uncovered them. And you see, all of these people have been allowed to put a little booties on and crawl up them. And they're having this religious experience, and they're kissing them. And there's a cross that is one of those crosses that looks like one of the war emblems from Nazi Germany at the top of it. The Iron Cross. And they're just having this religious experience. And just go, good God, what's wrong with you disgusting people crawling around on your hands and knees up these stairs like this relic which miraculously appeared in the Vatican? Is doing that is something that is pleasing to your God. Or the Notre Dame, which means Our Lady, named after Asherah, Queen of Heaven, Mother of God, burns down, and within 2 days, they've raised $1 billion to rebuild it.
For a church owned by one of the wealthiest organizations in the freaking world.
Oh, yeah, their Catholic Church doesn't own Notre Dame. You know that?
Oh, they have. I didn't know.
No, Notre Dame's owned by the French government. The Catholic Church didn't want to pay all the money to repair it, so the French government took it over, and they built it back, and for the last, I don't know how many years, it's been owned by the French government. They give the Catholic Church the right to use it.
The Catholic Church is busy paying off the lawyers to keep their pedophile priests out of jail.
There you go. So anyway, this is very, very clear. You should literally and completely convey to them that these godly appointed meeting times of Yahweh, which are set apart invitations to be called out and meet, to be near them, shall be continuously proclaimed by you as my godly appointed meeting times. Kara, Leviticus 23, 1 and 2. From there, God does something really interesting. He establishes the pattern that all of his call-out assemblies are going to follow. 6 plus 1, 7. You know, it's one of the oddest things in all of the study of human history, if you're really open to it. Why does the entire world agree that there's a 7-day week? With a lunar cycle that's 29 and a half days, the week should be 6 days or 5 days. Either 5 or 6 works beautifully. 7? Not so good. So 7 is really, really out of sync with a 29 and a half day cycle for a month. And so for the entire world to settle on 7, when civilization began even counting by 6s, time is the 6-base counting system. Direction with the compass is a 6-base counting system. The first civilizations had a 6-day week, and not one does today. And you know that every culture has a word for Shabbat. Every language.
Really?
6.
I didn't know that.
6 days. She shall consistently and continually actually engage in the service of the spiritual master. By the way, the reason I think that's the case is, yeah, I was really serious about the Shabbat thing. Really serious. She wants us to understand the power of that formula, 6 + 1 = 7. And that it underlays the entire time of human existence, of human history. It underlies all of the story of creation. It is the path back to Him. He wants us to understand that the story of Eden and the garden was told because that's where we're headed. If you don't like that story, you aren't going to like heaven because that's where we're going. The whole story has been told based on the 6 + 1. There are 6 dimensions in this universe, and Yah was in the 7th. Man was created on the 6th day, plus God, who is 1 = 7. That's the message. And so right here in the presentation of his Mikra, he says 6 days shall she consistently and actively engage in the service of the spiritual messenger. And then, in the 7th day, there shall be a Shabbat, a set-apart invitation to meet and to be called out as a Shabbaton. Anything with the O-W-N at the end of it means that which pertains to the Shabbat, which means that the Shabbaton can occur on any day of the week. It's just that the mindset of this is the intended destination. This is the answer to the equation.
The promise, yeah.
So it's all things pertaining to the Shabbat. Everything associated with the service of the spiritual messenger, you should not ever engage in or do. Her Shabbat is the goal of Yahweh's and all of your dwelling places throughout all time.
Yeah.
The Shabbat is the celebration of Sukkah. The Shabbat is the 7th of 7 Moed Mikre, of the 6 steps we take to God so that we end up on the 7th with Him. The 7th day is a celebration of being with God, where we rest and reflect on the idea that He did everything that was necessary for us to be in this position so long as we respond and accept the terms and conditions that He has provided. So it's the Shabbat and the basis of the Moed Mikre, of the 7 of them. It's the goal of Yahweh's for this to occur no matter where we live, no matter what time, no matter what generation. And I like the fact that he's said that this is the work of the set-apart spirit. It's her work. Because while Yosha fulfilled Pesach, that was the only one that was performed by the Passover lamb. The Passover lamb doesn't exist after Pesach is fulfilled.
Yeah.
All the rest,
it's one purpose,
are the work of the set-apart spirit. It's the set-apart spirit that took Yahweh's nefesh soul into Sheol, to Sheol, and retrieved Yahweh's nefesh soul from Sheol. The set-apart spirit that enabled the soul and the spirit to be reunited for firstborn children, Mukudim. It's the set-apart spirit that enriches and empowers us and lightens us as part of Shavua. It's the set-apart spirit that enables us to teruah, to trumpet out Yah's message. It's the set-apart spirit that is going to reconcile Yisrael and Yehuda with Yahweh, so that we can all camp out with Him when He returns. It's the set-apart spirit that's going to cleanse the earth of all religious and political corruption, blowing it all away before Yahweh returns. Powerful message. There's no room for a Easter Sunday in that.
No.
These godly appointed meeting times, Moed, of those dastardly Jews, of the elders of Zion, of the Catholic Church, of Christians everywhere. What does it say? These godly appointed meeting times of
Yahweh.
Yahweh. They're appointments and meeting times that Yahweh has fixed. Festival feasts at a specific designated time and place are set apart. Kodesh. Everything that's important to Yahweh is set apart. What does it mean that they are set apart, guys?
They're separated from the whole, purifying, set apart to a distinct purpose. They are unique and individual.
Mm-hmm. They are unique. What is common?
Everything else.
Man's way.
Ah, that's right. What's common is religion. What's common is politics. What's common is government. What's common is let the military go conquer the neighbor. What's common is man's way. Man's values in today's world, political correctness, multiculturalism are common. Christianity is common. Islam is common. You know, political rivalries and parties are common. God's way is the opposite of common. It's set apart from that which is common. It's set apart from man's way. You can either be part of man's way, conspiracy, for example, or you can be set apart unto Yahweh. So, the Moed, these appointed meeting times of Yahweh, these invitations are to be called out to meet, are set apart for the relationship and for your benefit. To be called out and welcomed, approaching with them at their appointed time. This is Kara 23:4. In the first month, the first Rishon month, Kodesh, time of renewal, which Yahweh establishes as Abib, has already established as Abib in the Exodus Shemot account. On the 14th day of that month, for the purpose of understanding Bien at the twilight, is Passover, Pesach, an act of sparing and providing immunity from Pesach to Passover, according to JB, according to Kirk, according to Yahweh. If you don't like it, you can pick up the argument with him, but I wouldn't do that if I were you.
Mm-mm.
That's a really poor life choice. Now, by the way, in the book of Kara, the heart of the Torah, in the middle of the book of Kara, which is in the middle of the Torah, this is all it says about Pesach. Why? Because God gave us credit for being smart enough to make the connections for understanding the Bien, to realize that if you read the book from the beginning to the end, rather than from the end to the beginning or from the middle out, you would know that he's already explained Pesach. He doesn't need to explain it again.
You can't just open it up, pick a random spot, and go from there?
Yeah.
You can't just pick it up and go, what does God want for my life? And point at a spot and go, I'm going to start here?
You know,
come on.
He's explaining Pesach.
It's easy for me.
Right. In context with the enslavement of the chosen people of Israel and Yehuda, of their enslavement in the crucible of human oppression, in the place that most exemplified religious oppression, political oppression, economic oppression, and military oppression. That's where they were. They had been there enslaved for 400 years, and the first explanation of Pesach is there in that context. That's its first celebration. To take it out of that context is to deprive oneself of understanding.
Yeah.
So Pesach is the doorway out of human, religious, political, economic, and military oppression. Is that an extrapolation? Is that my opinion? Or is there any way to offer a conclusion that is consistent with the Iowa's testimony that's different than that?
I would say the first of the 10 statements on the tablets of stone pretty much that one as fact.
Yeah, I am Yahweh, your God, who led you out of slavery in the crucible of human oppression, Mitzrayim. You shall have no other gods. You shall not even exist with another god in my presence.
Pretty much cements it in concrete. I mean, not
particularly since the second of those statements says, don't be religious. Don't be around it. Don't be near it. Don't be engaged in it.
Don't
have anything to do with religion. And that fathers corrupt their children to the third and fourth generation, and one in a million, there'll be thousands who receive the benefits of the covenant by observing the terms and conditions of the covenant. So, in addition, Yahweh spoke to Moshe and to Aaron in light and free will. And of course, Moshe's name is perfect for this. One who draws out, as is Aaron's, source of light and choice. In the realm of the crucible of Egypt, serving as a metaphor for human, religious, and political oppression, for the purpose of saying, this month shall be your first and foremost time of renewal. It shall be for you and on your behalf the first month of the year.
Well, that changes.
Yeah. Fellas, you know what the Hebrew word is for month?
Kodesh.
Kodesh. Kodesh is based upon what verbal root?
Kodesh.
Kodesh. And by the way, how is Kodesh spelled differently than Kodesh in Hebrew?
Nothing.
It's not.
Yeah.
Because,
both. C-H-D-S-H.
Yeah.
Different.
Spelled exactly the same way. And what does Kadash mean?
Renew.
Renew. Yeah.
To renew. Yeah, to renew or to restore. So this is a very clear presentation. You know, what God is saying is, listen, the lunar year is just 12 months of 29.5 days or 354 days per year. So it has to be adjusted by adding a 13th month every 2 to 3 years on average. This procedure was remarkably accurate, making the average Hebrew year over any significant span of time 365.2468 days long compared to the Gregorian 365.2425 days in duration. This was accomplished based upon whether the barley was Abib when the first crescent moon of the spring was sighted. Since there isn't a handy barley farmer in proximity to most of Yahweh's children today, we can calibrate our year to God's by starting with the first crescent nearest the vernal equinox. Then Yahweh said, speak to the entire witnessing community of the children of Israel, of those who engage and endure with God, to say, on the 10th of this month, accordingly, each individual shall obtain keen on their behalf a mailman for himself and for his home, according to their father's households. So, 4 days before Pesach, get a lamb. Now, if you want to do this symbolically, you can go to the store and buy a lamb. We don't do, you know, there are some cultural things that serve to provide marvelous illustrations that aren't to be done. Lots of them. In fact, the Torah is filled with them. And almost everything in the Torah, in fact, I would say without exception, everything in the Torah we can learn from. There's many things in the Torah we ought not to. It's not about a bunch of rules to do. This is not that case. The reason for bringing the lamb into the home 4 days before Pesach was that while we as humans, as animals, require protein, we're carnivores. We're actually omnivores, but we function with protein. That lamb was going to serve as food. But Yahweh wanted his people to know the lamb before the lamb was prepared as dinner. Why? Because Yahweh is the lamb. And he wants his people to know him. He wants his people to be aware of the sacrifice he made to open up the doorway to life for them. That's why that lamb was there 4 days. Four is the completion of a time of testing of understanding. 4 days. Not a lot to ask. Become familiar with this lamb because he is the lamb. Then he said,
we've made a point of anytime we go anywhere that they have any type of, you know, petting zoo, we make a point of taking Delin to the lamb and talking to her about him. And, you know, not for any religious or, like, specific thing, but it's, like I said, I go back to it, it's a teaching tool. So we went 4 days before Pesach this year, and we picked out the leg of lamb. You know, that's what I usually grill up for Pesach is a leg of lamb. We picked it out. We brought it home. And we were trying to make those connections with her in terms of teaching her it. Yeah, it's not a matter of, you know, a religious, you know, got to do this, got to do this. It's just all about making those connections within a young mind. And she knows what lambs are. She's petted a lamb. She knows that they were live animals at one point, and she's made that connection with, you know, we eat this. And so we bring it in, and, you know, she helped me season it the other night. And we, you know, I like to marinate mine a few days in advance and kind of let it all settle just because, to me, it tastes better. But, you know, she helped me with all of that. So she was understanding and, you know, watching the care we take in this piece of meat. And it's just making those connections within her mind.
Right. And it's interesting, by the way, that it's the lamb. Because it's not a bull. It's not a raging animal. I don't know if you've ever been on a farm where you have cows. People don't interact with cows. You don't even want to be a cow out pasture. You know, the cows are aggressive, and they do not have an affinity for wanting to be around people's sheep. You don't see in a petting zoo lions, tigers, or bears.
I was just about to say, every petting zoo we've been to has sheep and lambs and goats.
And that's the primary animal of the petting zoo, is the lamb because of the attitude of the lamb. Yahweh is identifying himself with the lamb for that reason. He's approachable. He gets along with people. They have a lot of attributes that fit the covenant. And if the household is too small to endure with a lamb, then he and his neighbor who is near the Almighty's family shall share in accordance with the number of individuals according to the mouths to feed in computing the number of lamb. Not to be a burden. The lamb shall exist as an unblemished son, a 3-year-old. He shall be for you actually taken from the male lambs or from the female goats. Now, male lambs, the advantage of that is that one male lamb can impregnate and continue the herd and service a lot of female
many
goats.
Generations.
Right. If you're taking females, you would depopulate your herd in a hurry. If you're taking males, you're not. I was thoughtful in that regard. But Yahweh also did it because he was going to fulfill Pesach with the sun metaphor, masculine. All the rest are feminine in terms of the fulfillment. And he shall be for you, existing on your behalf, to be kept and cared for, to be observed until the 14th day of this month. And the entire community of the children of Israel shall take his life to encourage understanding around sundown. You know, it's interesting that the Roman Catholic Church has accused Jews of killing Jesus. No, of course, they're the Romans. Imperial Rome that killed and crucified, beat to a pulp and grilled, and then Imperial Rome became the Roman Catholic Church. So, I mean, they're factually wrong, but of course, you know, factually wrong is you can't kill God. And the whole idea of parading around and flaunting dead God on a stick has got to be among the dumbest things that man has ever done. Worshipping God is even dumber than parading dead God on a stick. You know, and a superior being, it would create an inferior being to worship him as a narcissist. A very dangerous individual. So you have to be really careful when you say that God wants to be worshipped because you're saying that God's a narcissist. That's a really bad conclusion. But right here, the reason I bring this up is this, that Yahweh wants the children of Israel to take the life of the Lamb. Because the lamb is being offered for them. It's going to nourish them. It's going to benefit them. It's going to provide the doorway to life. It's going to save them. And they want them to know it. And they want them to know the sacrifice the ultimate lamb made for their benefit. So it's interesting that God's encouraging them. If, you know, if the Roman Catholic Church actually understood this, then the Jews would have been celebrated for taking the life of the lamb. That was the instruction. They were supposed to do it. The whole community of Israel is to take the life of the lamb. The very thing that they're accused of doing is the very thing they should have done. Isn't that a delicious irony in history? And they should actually choose to take the blood and place it upon the two upright pillars of the doorway and also upon the lintel. And upon the homes were beneficially and on behalf of the relationship you eat inside. Because it's that doorway that is opened by the sacrifice of that lamb. And that sign on that doorway says that we get it. We made that connection. We understand that the doorway to our home, the doorway of Pesach, when we're celebrating Pesach, is the doorway to life. Now, we are still recording, but we're not broadcasting at this point because I was probably too verbose at the beginning of the program. But let's just go on a few more moments because 90%, maybe 95% of the listenership of this program listens to the archives, which would be the whole program. I don't very often quote from something that's found in the Greek text, but this one I thought was sort of interesting in that it ties in to this door. And this is from Revelation 3, 20 through 22. Behold, I put in place, I have established, I paid for, I maintain, I acknowledge the validity of, I recommend, and I stand upright so as to enable others to stand as to me. At the door, the portal, the entrance, and knock. If anyone hears and pays attention to my voice, and what did he have to say? He quoted from the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and opens the door, I will come into him and will enjoy a feast. Ah, P Pesach.
Sounds like Pesach to me.
And he with me. To him who prevails, I give to them the gift of sitting down with me on my throne, as I also prevailed, and even as I am now sitting with my Father on his throne. Who can hear, let him listen to what the Spirit says to those who are called out. Then they should genuinely choose to eat and to be completely nourished by way of the flesh during this night, roasted over a fire. Always eat it over matzah, unyeasted bread, and with bitter herbs. Well, that lamb is not like all the other animal sacrifices of religions. You sacrifice an animal to appease your deity, or you sacrifice another human to appease your deity. By the way, why would anyone think that the God who requires a human sacrifice is interested in saving humans? If your God wants you to sacrifice a human life, what do you think the odds are that God is interested in saving a human life?
Zero.
Funny. You know, it's just somewhere along the way. Why didn't somebody ask that question? Anyway, the purpose of the lamb.
Remember, someone once described it a while back as when you read the term altar in scripture, it's just a really fancy word for barbecue grill.
Yes, exactly.
Because there's no
desire
where asked us to sacrifice that we don't eat.
That is correct.
It's just grilling.
Roast it over a grill. You know, it's for you. It's to nourish you. Roast it over the grill. Today, the roasting over the fire is a barbecue. And then eat it.
Yeah.
What do you mean? You're eating the lamb. It's nourishing you. Eat it over what? Always eat it over what? Matzah. Because if you avail yourself of the doorway of life and you're not taking advantage of the removal of religious and political corruption at the same time, taking the yeast out, the grease, the alcohol, and beer and wine, and that ferments the bread, if you're not doing that, then what you're doing is counterproductive. You become eternal and still with all of your sins.
Yeah.
Why
so you'll learn what kodesh means.
Yeah, you'll learn. That is true. With bitter herbs. With, you know, the bitter herbs, I think the bitter herbs do a lot of things. And I'm just speculating here. But, of course, we'd say bitter herbs because it was a bitter sacrifice that not the lamb made, but that the Lamb of God made on our behalf. And the soul going into matzah made in on our behalf. You know, and that taking the religion out was an embittered, bitter thing for God to endure on our behalf. But, you know, spices, it adds flavor to life. You don't want that matzah, that unyeasted bread, to be blah. It'd be just blah, dry and tasteless and blah. But you dip it in olive oil, which is the symbol of the Spirit, with herbs. I want to tell you, I'd rather have it than candy. And in fact, that was one thing I was going to say. I'm not telling you anybody else to celebrate it this way. I'm just telling you that once I've acknowledged what Pesach is about, and I have all of the fixings there, my celebration is enjoying just how delicious it all is.
Mm-hmm.
And how wonderful.
The bitterness of the herbs works so well with the sweetness of the lamb. You know, they offset each other. They complement each other. Honestly, it's a great recipe. Even when I eat lamb now, outside of Pesach, I will still pick some bitter herbs to go with it.
Always.
We're talking about beer being the cornerstone of society. The whole reason hops became associated with beer was because they were looking for some way to offset the sweetness of the alcohol and the barley, and so they used hops. That's what hops do. They bitter the beer. And that bitterness balances with sweetness. The bitter
IBUs are bitter units.
The bitterness of the herbs balances the sweetness. The lamb is a very sweet meat in a lot of regards. You taste it. It's one of the reasons I love lamb. But you eat it with something that is a bit bitter.
Right. It adds to the fullness of the flavor.
You know, it's a menu. Right? It's a menu of pizza that complements so well.
Oh, who wrote this recipe?
No.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, people love to look at it as, the bread of oppression and the bitterness of this. No. It's a great recipe for things that go good together.
That's exactly right. And it says you should never consume any part of it raw or without due consideration. Wow. Or without due consideration. The raw thing is that you're just too lazy to cook it. The raw thing is you're going to eat the blood.
Yeah.
If you have to cook it over the fire, and you realize that fire is that symbol of not only light and therefore the set apart spirit of God appeared as the as fire, but also as to provide warmth and enlightenment for your family. But it's a way that you can participate in preparing the meal, so that when I ate the lamb tonight, I barbecued that lamb. I participated. I contributed something to it. It wasn't just laid out in front of me and you just gobble it down. It's so much more enjoyable when you participate in the process. And God said, that's what I want you to do. Don't just, salvation isn't by faith, by participation.
It's not passive.
Right. It's by participation. And I want you to give it due consideration. Don't consume the lamb without due consideration. Don't boil it, cooking it in water, but instead as a condition, roasting it above a fire.
Over
in that particular case, its head and legs attached and its inner parts close by. I want you to know that this is who he is and what he has done for us. And you shall make something sure that nothing remains of him prior to morning. And so the remainder of him prior to the approach of morning, you shall literally and consistently burn up in the fire. Could Yosha have been the Passover lamb if his body was not consumed and burnt up that night? And therefore, if God can't fulfill the Torah as it's written,
he's a liar.
And there is no salvation from it. He's not God if he can't observe the Torah and fulfill it as it's written. His body had to be consumed that night, which means that the whole myth associated with Easter is nothing but a pagan lie.
Now, Christianity is lose-lose. Either you lose and Yahweh was a liar, or you lose and Yahweh told the truth.
Yes.
If he told the truth,
that was your God. If he lied, and the body didn't have to be burned up that night, then your faith is in something that is untrue. And if he told the truth,
I'm going back to what we talked about at the beginning. That's 100% with what you talked about. Why did no one recognize him? His own mother didn't recognize him.
Correct.
If he was bodily resurrected, she would have.
But
his body was completely and utterly destroyed.
Yes. But beyond that, even no one recognized him all 4 to 5 times that he appeared post Bukhutim, firstborn children. If his body wasn't enveloped in fire that night, ceasing to exist,
he didn't fulfill the Torah.
Right. That he's not the Pesach lamb. That simple. He could not have fulfilled it if he didn't fulfill it. And this is how you should always be nourished by him.
The Shroud of Turin is actually one of the few relics that seems to have any legitimacy.
Yes. And I'm not certain that it does, but I want to tell you that the way that it appears, which is that like it was irradiated, radiation from the inside, left this impression of an individual who had been crucified. And that it was essentially a negative of what happens with the radiation and light. Yeah, so it is exactly what you would have expected. And this is how you should always be nourished by him, with the tie fastened around your waist and with your sandals on your feet and with your staff in your hand. You should choose to eat it, being completely nourished by him quickly. This and he is Passover, according to Yahweh. The reason Yahweh says, I want you to be ready to go, is it's the doorway to life. It's the first of seven steps, and the next day we're going to take the second step. And if you're not ready to take that second step, like I told our guest at dinner this evening, at Passover, if you're not ready to accept that next step, you're having a tasty lamb dinner, and this is not Passover.
You're having a lovely dinner.
Right, but it ain't Passover for you. And I kept on telling him that. If you're not willing to take the next step of matzah, this is not Passover for you. But if you are ready to take that next step, if you can't wait for unyeasted bread and then bekodem and celebrate being adopted into Yahweh's family, then you're ready to go. You got your walking shoes on. You got your sandals on. You're ready to go. And this idea of eating it quickly. There's a lot of things Yahweh says that I love because I share the same affinity. I'll sit down to a meal. And if I'm out for dinner, for example, I will give the waiter or waitress my credit card halfway into the meal. And, you know, I want to order the minute we sit down. Because time matters to me. That's the thing we have the least of, is time in this mortal life. And I eat it, enjoy it, have your conversation, and when it's over, go and do something else. But just to lounge around and drink and the light, that's not my thing. Yahweh says it's not his thing either. Eat it quickly. Let's go on. Let's be prepared to do the next thing together. This and he is Passover, according to Yahweh. So I will choose to pass over the realm of the crucible of Mitzrayim during this night, and strike every firstborn son of the land of Egypt, including man and even animal. And upon all of the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment and render punishment. I am Yahweh. The blood will exist for you and a sign on the homes where you, by way of relationship, are at that time. So when I see the blood, I will choose to actually pass over you on that account and for that reason. That's one of the fun things about Pesach. Take a little of the lamb before you grill it. Put it on the door. Just a nice way of symbolically saying, I get it.
We use barbecue sauce or ketchup usually with the lid because it's a little more visible than the running from the lamb.
Yeah.
But yeah, we do that.
It's symbolic anyway.
She paints it and we talk about it with her and all that.
Yeah. And the plague leading to death and destruction shall not exist among you when I strike in the realm of the crucible of Egypt. What is the plug? What is the last thing he said is that he is going to do away with on this night, Pesach? The gods of Egypt, Osiris,
yep.
Amun-Ra, Isis, the Babylonian, the Egyptian trinity that was previously the Babylonian trinity. Horus, the Apis, the bull coat cult of the pharaohs. So the plague is the ways of man, of the crucible of religious, political, economic, and military oppression. And it's God's removing the plague by by removing all of the religious artifacts from the land.
Wow.
This day will exist on your behalf, not for God, for our behalf, as a memorial and reminder. He didn't say it's being established on your behalf as a religious ritual rite, as a way to remember what God did and what it represents. And you should choose to genuinely and completely celebrate with him a festival feast to approach Yahweh throughout all of your lives and generations. Continually and genuinely celebrating the festival feast with him as an engraved prescription for living forever. I have nothing to add to that.
Well, it's pretty clear.
Nothing to debate.
That's
nothing to argue.
Pretty powerful right there.
Place to stop. Yeah.
This day, Passover, will exist as a memorial and reminder. And you should choose to genuinely and completely celebrate with him a festival feast to approach Yahweh throughout all of your lives and generations, continuously and genuinely celebrating the festival feast with him as an engraved prescription for living forever. Shemoth, Names, Exodus 12:14. To one and all, happy Pesach, wonderful matzah, and a lovely celebration of Bukurim. Fellas, look forward to being with you this time next week.
I couldn't think of a better ending than that right there.
No, that was wonderful. Thank you.
Shalom.
Shalom.
Shalom. Good night.
Good night. See you guys next week. Bye.